This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Week in Review on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and welcome to the show that puts the media and the news in the spotlight. This week, we take a look back at major headlines in 2014 from the perspective of the media. But before that, we have three stories from Asia Calling. Restoring the artistic traditions of Afghanistan. An unexpected caretaker of North Korean graves in the south. And joint Nobel Peace Prize winner on a mission to combat extremism. Afghanistan was once a great center of civilization at the heart of the Silk Route. It blended the traditions of India, Persia, and Central Asia and created its own unique artistic culture. Decades of conflict have almost destroyed these rich traditions. In the time of the Taliban, many artisans were forced to flee the country and many buildings were destroyed. But now, the non-profit Turquoise Mountain Foundation is trying to restore the old city of Kabul and the artistic traditions of that country. Gaya Waziri went to visit them.
This small part of Kabul's old city is called Muradkhani. Centuries ago, craftsmen carved these structures out of wood. But years of war and poverty and neglect had left the place covered in rubbish. It had no electricity and its houses were under threat from developers. But now new builders are here, backed by the non-profit Turkish Mountain Foundation. The effort is trying quickly to restore this portion of Kabul's dignity in history before it's lost forever. Abdul Wahid Khalili is the director of Turkish Mountain.
Afghanistan is suffering the last three decades of war. And almost during this three decades of war, we lost lots of Afghan cultural heritage, which one part of that could be the Afghan artisan. Some of them, they have been went from Afghanistan and they are living in some other countries. In some of them, because of their age, they have passed away.
In order to restore the buildings, they have built an institute to train a new generation of Afghans in woodwork, calligraphy, and miniature painting. In one of the classrooms, 19-year-old Ahmed Rashid is carving a dove in wood.
I have been working on this carving for about 2 months. I'm nearly finished. The dove is a symbol of peace, something that we desperately need in this country. I will graduate next year, and I'm confident I can make a living from this profession, as rich people are now showing an interest.
His teacher Bakir Alizada helped renovate the splendor Koti Bakhcha and Dilkusha palaces that were built in the 1920s.
I love my profession and my country's historical places because they tell our history and show how significant Afghanistan is in the development of Islamic architecture.
Jewelry is another classic art form that is being taught here at this Institute for Afghan Arts and Architecture. 18 years old, Mariam is studying to be a goldsmith.
When I graduate from this institute, I will continue my work to revive the classical jewelry craft which has been lost. It is very important to revive historical places, but also to make sure a new generation of people keep our artistic heritage alive.
Zabiullah Nouri, the group's communication coordinator, says they are now getting orders from overseas.
Our jewelry is very popular in Europe. Our jewelry sells well there, particularly in the United Kingdom. We also have staff working on a 5-star hotel in Saudi Arabia, and very soon we will have a contract with the Qatar Museum.
Foisha Kaling, this is Ghayur Waziri from Kabul, Afghanistan.
Tensions between North and South Koreans have abated over recent years despite ideological differences between the countries. However, many South Koreans still consider those in the North as enemies, whether living or dead. But as Jason Strother discovers, one South Korean has put politics aside in order to care for the spirits of deceased enemies. He reports from Paju, north of Seoul.
Alongside the highway that runs from Seoul to the barbed wire fences of the Demilitarized Zone, there is an all but forgotten cemetery. And for one South Korean Buddhist monk, it's a truly sacred site. His name is Mukge, and his chanting is meant to ease the suffering of the spirits that inhabit this graveyard. His head is shaved, and he wears a gray tunic. He taps on his small drum as he walks past the headstones that dot the hillside. These graves belong to 769 North Korean soldiers. The 58-year-old monk says he doesn't consider them as enemies.
It isn't about sympathy. They were soldiers, and soldiers obey their orders. In Buddhism, they say when people die, they do not vanish. Their bodies go away, but their souls still exist and are later reborn in many different forms.
When the Korean War ended in 1953 with a ceasefire agreement, thousands of soldiers were left in mass graves scattered along both sides of the peninsula. In 1996, the South Korean government chose this spot, about 20 kilometers south of the DMZ, to bury the North Korean fighters. And because of the ongoing tensions between the South and the North, these soldiers might never make it back home. The monk Mukge says he didn't know much about this graveyard until 3 years ago, when ghosts dressed in military uniforms and with gaping wounds began visiting him during his meditation. They telepathically communicated. He says they told him they missed their families and needed love. And after 3 months of repeated visits from these spirits, he began caring for them at the cemetery.
At first, it was scary seeing these ghosts, but I got used to it. When you die, you don't age. So all these guys, I feel like they are my sons.
Mukge says one of the ghosts might have been Chinese. He thinks it was one of the spirits of the 400-plus Chinese soldiers that died alongside and then were buried next to the North Koreans in the graveyard. Earlier this year, those bodies were exhumed and repatriated to China. But Mukge doesn't think it was a good idea.
They never wanted to go back to their homeland because their parents have all passed away and they have no family there. It was a political decision to send those bodies back to their country, and it's not helpful for their souls.
In addition to the North Koreans that died during the Korean War, are a few dozen graves of soldiers that came to fight the South many years later. Those include commandos who once tried to assassinate the South Korean president.
This remains a key infiltration route from North Korea, which is just 35 miles in that direction.
Andrew Salmon, author of two books on the Korean War, points out the spot in downtown Seoul where that deadly firefight took place in 1968. He isn't so sure that North Korea actually wants the bodies of those soldiers back.
I can't speak for the North Korean government. This is purely speculation on my behalf, but this was a deniable operation, a black operation. So if they accepted the bodies back, they're accepting that they conducted the operation.
Whatever their operation was, Mukge doesn't care, and since beginning his mission to soothe the North Korean souls, the monk has inspired others to join him. They come here once a month. They leave bottles of alcohol and food in front of the graves as offerings to the spirits. Mukge says it hasn't always been easy to convince other South Koreans that he's doing the right thing.
Why are you doing this for soldiers from an enemy country? People used to say to me, and they protested and they bothered us. But now they don't do that anymore. They think what I'm doing is positive.
Mukge leans down to clear some of the weeds that have grown around one of the headstones. Even though the two Koreas are still technically at war, he says he'll care for the North Korean graves until there's finally peace.
Once they are dead, we should forgive everything they did in life. It's an old tradition of the East.
Mukge takes a deep bow in front of one of the headstones, saying goodbye to the invisible spirits as he taps out one last rhythm on his drum. For Asia Calling, I'm Jason Strother in Paju, South Korea.
Well, just about everyone has heard of this year's 17-year-old Nobel Peace Prize winner, Malala Yousafzai. Few are familiar with the joint winner, Kailash Satyarthi. The Nobel Prize Committee said in referring to its choice this year that it regarded it as an important point for a Hindu and a Muslim, an Indian and a Pakistani to join in a common struggle for education against extremism. Satyarthi went to Stockholm this week to explain how to combat what he calls the stealing of the future of millions of poor children who are forced to work. Rick Wasserman has the story.
The demure figure in a white shirt and wool vest was greeted by a standing ovation. Kailash Satyarthi spoke softly but intensely at the Stockholm Nobel Forum about the pain he feels for the millions of child laborers. He's been fighting for their rights for over 3 decades. He remembered a Nepali boy who he led a peace march with, who asked him a simple question about poverty.
Is the world so poor that it cannot keep a toy or a book instead of forcing me to take a tool or a gun?
Only through uniting our efforts on a global scale can we really make progress in protecting children's rights, Satyarthi says.
For me, as an ordinary grassroots activist, I feel that the solutions are found on the ground, where the problem exists. And with the people, individuals, local organizations, local NGOs, who may not be known to you and me, who have not been given any award or not yet been recognized, the solution lies with them.
He founded Bachpan Bachao Andolan, or the Movement to Save Childhood, in 1980. The organization has rescued and rehabilitated over 80,000 child laborers. But there are an estimated 168 million children in the world today who are still working in often dangerous conditions. Satyarthi says he would like to see a global center for children's rights set up.
An institute or a center or a place where all these grassroots experiences and the academic knowledge could merge and further propelled, further used by NGOs, by businesses, by governments, by intergovernmental agencies, by everyone.
Rene Andersson, ethics and environmental manager at Indiska, a major clothing importer in Scandinavia, says that enacting child labor laws only helps to a certain extent.
When I started 16 years ago to audit companies, suppliers to us in India and in China and in our other production countries, it was really, really horrible, also for adults. We found out that the labor laws in both India, China, Bangladesh are almost as good as the Swedish laws, but they were not implemented.
Poverty, says Satyarthi, is always brought up as the cause and excuse for a child to be exploited, often by their own families. But he says we are suffering from a different kind of poverty.
The poverty lies somewhere inside us. The poverty of compassion. The poverty of mutual responsibility. Everybody has an element of compassion. Let us unite this compassion to unite the world.
A transfer of 6 days of military spending in rich countries to education would put all children in school by 2015. 15% of the money spent yearly on tobacco in the U.S. would do the same. From Stockholm, this is Rick Wasserman for Asia Calling.
Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Brito Radio Anam Lapanha in Jakarta. Next up, we look at the year 2014 from the perspective of the media. I'm Sharad Kutin, and you're listening to The Week in Review, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and The Week in Review continues. It's been a challenging year for the Malaysian media, with the general political landscape growing more authoritarian and extraordinary events like the disappearance of MH370 testing the media's ability to provide factual and accurate reporting. We spoke to editors, journalists and observers to get a sense of how 2014 played out for the media. Zaram Naim is Professor of Media and Communication Studies at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia. He identified some of the biggest news stories that the media had to deal with this year.
Biggest news stories. Internationally, I'd say the rise of the Islamic State, Ebola, of course, the MH370 tragedy, the MH17 as well, yeah. Then, of course, there's the democracy protests in Hong Kong. I think less reported has been the fall in oil prices internationally, but the rise in petrol pump prices in Malaysia, you know, a bit ironic. More flippantly, I guess, in terms of pop culture, it was Frozen soundtrack dominating the airwaves and annoying a lot of people. Yeah, that's basically it. But I think most seriously, internationally, it was the rise of IS, Ebola, which is still a problem, I guess. Yeah, if you're thinking in terms of nationally, I would say increasing undemocratic control, like the use of the Sedition Act, an act which is archaic already, which I believe shouldn't be used at all. But even when it's used now, it's used very, very badly. Yeah, it's used on certain groups of people, certain individuals, but not on others. So nationally, I think that's very sad. That's very pathetic, actually, this increasing use of undemocratic sort of means to control the people. Secondly, one saw nationally, I would say, would be increasing intolerance, yeah? Bigotry, racism, the rise in greater publicity for various groups, yeah? Like Bokassa, like Isma. And these have not been stopped by the leaders. In many cases, people believe that they're being encouraged, yeah? And so that's not very good. That's really worse than not being, underplaying the whole thing, but really it's really bad for the country, yeah? The increasing intolerance, the Allah ban, for example, the controversy surrounding that, and like I said, the rise of Isma and Perkasa, yeah? Then there's been assaults on the constitution as well, you know, underlying all of this, the belief that there is an attempt to not only reconstitute the constitution, but essentially to destroy it. And I think that's very, very dangerous, and I think we all have to be a bit more vigilant as citizens as to all these attempts, yeah, these undemocratic attempts to change the way society progresses.
Leslie Lau is executive editor of the Malay Mail Online. He analysed how the media covered major issues such as the Malaysia Airlines tragedies.
In terms of MH370, I think generally we probably acquitted ourselves reasonably well. But having said that, it was a global story, and one would be that it showed a lack of resources on our part when it came to stories like that, understandably so, from Malaysian media companies. The other issue would be there was some slight tendency to be a bit nationalistic, if you like, in covering the stories like MH370. There's this sort of habit we fall back on sometimes, generally the media, to defend the country as if we are under siege as well, you know, instead of just primarily looking at it as a story, which would have been the main focus in terms of covering any story. We should just look at it factually as a story, I think.
Premis Chandran is CEO and co-founder of Malaysia Kini. He noted that issues like the disappearance of MH370 are not easy to cover.
With the Malaysian Airlines stories, I think they were both very difficult stories to cover, with not much of information, you know, being around. I think the sedition issues, I think that they could have done a better job covering them generally. There's a lot more to be said about it. And I think with regards to religious tensions, I think it's an ongoing story. There's been, you know, numerous articles from numerous parties, something which needs better coverage as well as we go forward.
Malaysian Insider CEO Jahabah Sadiq explained how media ownership structures affects standards of journalism.
The thing is, when anyone talks about Malaysian journalism standards, defined there, you have the licensed media, that's broadcast, that includes yourself, you have print, and they generally conform to restrictions in their licenses. And most of the media is owned by parties which are friendly to the government, be it businessmen or political parties. So they can only work within the constraints imposed on them. I don't think we can even say they have any quality on a global standard, maybe except for one or two media. But more often than not, I think inspirational standards or very high standards come from the online media and very few select broadcast media.
In September this year, Malaysia Kini journalist Susan Leung was arrested after publishing an interview with a Penang assemblyman involved in the People's Voluntary Patrol Unit controversy. What lay behind this move? We asked Malaysia Kini's Premish for his thoughts.
Within the country and the government about whether they want to liberalise the media or not, I think this is a debate they're going to continue next year. I think the government feels that they really need to control the media in order to win back public support. So I think we will see, you know, ongoing discussion regarding, you know, the freedom of the press.
Insider's Jahaba Sadiq echoed Premish's opinion.
Generally, I think Malaysian media has reached a stage where we have a whole group of editors who are brought up to think that the government is supreme. We have a whole group of young reporters who are not really interested in the job. They do it because they want it on their CV. They think there's some glamour in it. They think there is a necessity to say, I worked in the media, and then they go on to their next jobs. But the laws remain the same. The Sedition Act was wielded more in 2014 than any other years, mainly as a way of telling people to conform to a certain line, to not question things because deemed seditious by the authorities or certain groups in Malaysia. It's more political than anything else. It's just to remind people there's no ISA, but we have other laws to keep people in check.
Press freedom should be allowed, but under certain constraints, argues Anwar Manso, a journalist with Utusan Malaysia Online.
The fact is that if the local media, the national media, right, there will be, of course, all the laws and all the wish of the public so that the local media will be given more freedom, right? But then again, we have to look at it this way. Is there any such great degree of freedom being given to any media in anywhere? So, yeah, I do agree. At a certain point, the media should be given total freedom, more press freedom. But it depends on what the media would do with it. Of course, for the side of the mainstream media, we would really support what the government is doing. But for the alternative media, they would go all out in support of the other party. Up to the point, if you look at the reporting being done, both by the mainstream media and the alternative media, there's a lot of unclarified news being thrown out to the public by the alternative media. One good example is the GST. You ask the public, right, based on what they read on new media, alternative media, right, they perceive GST as to be government service tax. It's goods and services tax, right? So if even the news has been misunderstood by the public because of the reporting done by certain parties, then just imagine if something bigger will happen. So can you imagine that what the impact and the effect will be to the public, to the government and to everyone?
On government media relations, Anwar strikes a somewhat discordant note, arguing that the media should be supportive of government policies.
Well, I think our media have learned that we can no longer rely on traditional methods of conveying news to the public. We have to be really fast. Because what happened with MH370 and MH70 is that the other related things, right? The conspiracy theories, the I know better than you people, basically riddling the internet. So these are the things that confuses the public. Up to a certain point, it causes somewhat of ketidakpercayaan kepada setengah-setengah pihak. That is what it has caused. So for local media, right, for us, we need to be really well prepared. We need to beat all these unverified stories from going out. Because, as I said before, the impact and the effect of that is quite big in a way and could cause so many negative impacts to the country, to the people, and even to those who are involved in that case. Look what happened to Mas, right? Because of MH370 and MH70, which is two different isolated cases. But the image that has been portrayed by the unverified news and by those conspiracy theories and whatnot, it caused Mas to be really badly affected. So this is what we don't want, right? It's not Mas' fault, right? When it happened, right? But Mas got to blame for nothing. It's an accident. But the one who's being blamed by the public, by the world, is us. I always believe that the media is the one who's got the Malay world who be yang akan memastikan government melakukan apa yang patut government buat. Okay? For example, when Prime Minister announced the budget for 2015, right, the duty of the media to sampaikan to the public, what are the benefits of this budget being presented? How can the public take advantage from the budget being presented? What are the effects that the budget is going to have on everything in the country? That is what the media should do. I'm not saying totally support. I'm saying that the media, the role of the media should be as the one who reminds the government, okay, this is what you should do. This is what you should not do. If you go all out and bash all the government every single minute of the day, right? Whatever the government do is wrong. Whatever the government do is wrong. Then when are the people going to have something right?
Despite the increased use of the Sedition Act, Malay Mail Online's Leslie Lau is optimistic that there's been positive growth in the media industry.
I think one of the great things that's happening, that's continuing to happen in the Malaysian media scene would be the fact that there are more media outlets now, you know, which can only be good. Competition is always good. We compete, obviously, for the advertising dollar. or advertising ringgit, since we're talking about the domestic market here, right? And we compete on ideas. We compete on presentation. There are so many news websites now. My website, Malay Mail Online, we started basically last year only. And you have so many new websites that have come up. So many things and so many ideas out there that are greatly welcomed. I think that is the great development. I think they talk about in 1999, which was when Malaysia Kini first started on the internet, there was no rival for Malaysia Kini, basically, right? So if you go back further, in the 1950s, when we gained independence as a country, basically we only had the Straits Times, as it was called then. Yep. So later on, you had the Star. Okay, so if you look at it, it took a long time before there were real rivals within the main media outlets. But now, because of the internet, you see this tremendous growth. And I think in the last year, you're seeing more of it. More people are going on the internet. More people are having a say, which can only be good.
In such an environment, Zarim Naim suggests that there are a few lessons the media can learn from the events of 2014.
Well, when you talk about Malaysian media, you're talking about different groups in the media. I don't think the owners and controllers of the media have learned very much in that sense, yeah? They still want to control, they still want to maintain oligopolistic control over the media, right? So I think they know that nothing's changed as far as they're concerned. What I think journalists need to learn from 2014 is that even if you're quiet, nothing's going to, the controls will still be there, yeah? I think it's time for journalists and broadcasters as well to decide that, you know, there is a need to at least look for truth rather than do what's called cue journalism. Follow on cue what the people up there say, you see? My ex-colleague has called it cue journalism, C-U-E, cue journalism. And I think what journalists and broadcasters need to learn, at least is need to learn from 2014, is that that has to go, right? Because if you look at circulation rates now, the latest circulation results indicated that newspapers are, and these are the major newspapers, are losing, the circulation is going down, right? So it doesn't help if all you're going to talk about is stuff that is supportive of the status quo. And I think the popularity of internet news now, right, not only with Malaysia Kini, with the Malaysian Insider as well, indicates that Malaysians are ready for or even hungry for different types of news, not just propaganda, yeah, and propaganda of one particular nature as well. I think that has to go, and I think journalists ought to understand, journalists and other media personnel ought to know that. And I think the media owners do know that, right? But given the nature of media control and ownership in Malaysia, I guess they don't want to change things. If anything at all, I think if my wish for 2015 would be that there is a change in the way that media organizations are owned and controlled, in terms of the policies that define the laws, and also in terms of the personnel controlling the media.
Leslie adds to this the challenges of adapting to a 24-hour news cycle that audiences now demand.
I'm not sure, but I would think it would be the same lessons again and again. I think the internet has made it, because news is instant now, it's more difficult to verify stories. The lessons we have to take is to go back to basic journalism, which would be to verify and to get our facts right. Admittedly, it's more and more difficult to do that because we need to push out the story quickly. We need to get it out quickly, or our rivals will get it out. There's all this pressure, okay? And I think we have to go back to basics sometimes and look at how we can verify stories better. I mean, at the end of the day, even if your rivals don't scoop you, as they used to say, right? Facebook would, Twitter would. Yeah, the public, you're competing with the public itself in disseminating information. And frequently the media is the one playing catch up. For one, I think for MH370, it was difficult to verify anything. And there was so much pressure to be fair. There was so much pressure on the authorities to tell us something. Looking back, I think it is pretty obvious that in terms of public perception, they failed. But I think the failure in terms of the authorities in disseminating information, I think it contributed to the inability of the media to verify things. And because things are just moving so fast in terms of trying to get news out. And I think, you know, I hate to say this, when I say we as public rather than the media, we as the public have to take some blame for that. Because we as media consumers, we expect things to happen, you know? We expect new developments. Just because there's 24 hours TV, there's 24 hours news on the internet, you expect things to happen. And unfortunately, in the case of MH370, even up to today, pretty much nothing has happened. You know, that's a sad thing, you know.
That was Leslie Lau of the Malay Mail Online speaking of one of the many challenges that the media faced this year. Challenges that not only have to do with shifting political dynamics, but also the rapidly changing demands of the industry, much of it shaped by consumers. Throughout this year, The Week in Review has tried to engage in an ongoing conversation, both local and global, about the challenges facing the media. We would like to thank Anwar Mansur of Utusan Malaysia Online, Jahabar Sadiq of the Malaysian Insider, Malaysia Kini's Premish Chandran and Zaram Naim of the University of Nottingham, Malaysia for contributing to today's conversation. And I hope this morning's show has been food for thought for you. And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. That's all we have for you on The Week in Review. I'm Sharad Kutin for BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.